It is 8:30, and we have with us live in the studios once again, Jav Parrish and Maria Tomchik, co-editors at Eat the Steak. Good morning.
Good morning.
Morning.
How are you both today?
Good, good, good.
I'm okay. A little depressed. I'm reading the news this week.
Oh, yeah. All right. Well, that's going to be our
really? What happened?
Our lead topic.
I hope I'm not the only one talking about this.
Yeah. Anyway. I don't know how anyone could miss what happened this week.
No, it's pretty
Katrina.
Nasty. Yeah, and above all, I mean, the first thing that needs to be said, the federal government's response to this was absolutely abysmal. I mean, this is an embarrassment for what the richest country in the world to be unable to get basic aid to people in 5 days. The scenes playing on television screens should be enough to embarrass any American in this country. And it comes back to a federal government that is not only ideologically skewed, but just basically incompetent under the Bush administration.
Clearly, it was a reflection of the Bush administration's priorities, too, in the last four years.
Yeah.
Every year that George Bush has been in office, funds for shoring up the levees in New Orleans and doing flood control work in southern Louisiana have been cut, and most severely cut in the last 2 years in order to fund, first Homeland Security and now the war in Iraq. So we really can put this down to... we really can lay this at George Bush's feet and say this is another side effect of the war in Iraq. It's another casualty of the war in Iraq is the city of New Orleans.
Yeah, and we and then he talks about, well, nobody could have anticipated a breach of the levees. I mean, my God, it's been anticipated repeatedly, time after time after time, by emergency planners. In the year 2000, the FEMA listed the three most potentially major disasters to hit the United States.
This was before September 11th.
A terrorist attack on New York, a major hurricane striking New Orleans, an earthquake striking San Francisco. I mean, I'd be pretty nervous over San Francisco right now. But this has been anticipated many, many times. FEMA had an exercise to plan for this very eventuality 1 year ago. We had a dress rehearsal in Hurricane Ivan 1 year ago. This has been anticipated time after time after time, and yet the funds have been dried up. And when the disaster did strike, the communications was horrible. The basic foodstuffs were unavailable. Obviously, security broke down entirely. It's been a disaster.
Now, folks might say, okay, now, sure, some of that's the federal government. Some of it's also local officials. And that's true. Local officials bear some responsibility, particularly for the evacuation of the city. When the mayor went on the horn on Saturday and said, okay, this is a mandatory evacuation, everybody must leave, there was no provision made for people who did not have automobiles or any way to get out of the city, didn't have enough money to buy bus tickets or airfare.
Now, and coming at the end of the month when people didn't have cash in hand.
This is a city of 500,000 people. 67% are African American. 34% of the population live below the poverty line. The poverty line is extremely low, something like $12,000 to $13,000 a year for a two-person family. That's extremely low. There are many people who are above the poverty level who still cannot afford to buy a car or maintain it or buy bus tickets or plane tickets and move their whole family out of the city. So, you know, at first... estimates were that there were 50 to 100,000 people who had stayed behind, but when you really do the numbers, it's going to be around 200,000 or maybe more.
And we've seen that in the crowds this week at the convention center and the Superdome.
Yeah.
Obviously, there are many more people just at those two locations than the 50 to 100,000.
And there are many, many more who haven't made it to those locations yet, who are still hanging out on the rooftops of buildings and in other places. So, yeah, so there's that, too. To consider that in all of the planning meetings done on the local level by city and county officials, that nobody had made any plans for what do you do with the low mobility population, the poor, the elderly, the folks who don't have cars. Open the Superdome? Well, that sits, 30,000 people. That's all. you know, when you've got 200,000 people to take care of, that's completely and utterly inadequate. Now, in addition,
the Superdome's conditions were fetid within 24 hours. I mean, yeah. that was no solution at all.
Yeah, and in addition, you know, there's the role that FEMA plays in a disaster, and that role is generally one of communication and coordination. Now, you've got local rescue officials, you have state and county rescue officials, you have volunteers from all over the country who come in, you have neighboring states who have rescue teams that they send.
You have the National Guard. Oops, I'm sorry, that's not available.
Yeah, and then you have FEMA that coordinates it all. And FEMA relies on these lower level rescue agencies to have the proper communications equipment, and on police forces and local and state and county police forces to have the communications in place so that coordination can be done. Well, there were two basic places where this whole thing fell through. One is that FEMA has been gutted by the Bush administration. They moved it from being an independent agency to one that's underneath the Department of Homeland Security, buried in a couple layers of bureaucracy, and all of the money that used to go to FEMA to help out with this kind of coordination and all the money that used to go into disaster relief funds has been diverted to terrorism. Anti-terrorism work.
And that's been basically new toys. It hasn't been for communication system,
right,
or the basic sort of infrastructure that can also help out in a natural disaster.
That's the second thing. On the local level, any money that was received by local law enforcement officials was often put towards these anti-terrorism, you know, training things and, you know, toys for anti-terrorism work, and very, very little into making sure that there was adequate communications in case of a disaster. Probably the most important homeland security issue is whether or not you can help a population that is going to be immediately and terribly at risk in case of a natural disaster, and that wasn't done.
Yeah, or for that matter, a terrorist attack. I mean, you have to have communications for any of that kind of thing, and that has not been in place, and it would not be in place in New Orleans. It wouldn't be in place in Seattle. This is something that's a basic failure across the country, and we've learned that from this disaster.
And that's what came out of the limited 9/11 investigations, was the communications, that the lack of radios that were available, and that the radios that they did have were all, you know, trying to use the same channels, and nobody could talk to each other.
Yeah, the 9/11 investigations that the White House didn't want to have. I mean, didn't implement the findings from. I mean, obviously we didn't learn those lessons.
Yeah, that's right. And so that's clearly an important piece of this whole thing. But you know, my immediate response to a lot of this was that first of all, that it was caused by the war on terror and the war in Iraq. You know, surely that didn't cause the hurricane, but the whole disaster that happened afterwards. I mean, New Orleans was not directly hit by the hurricane, but the levees failing was certainly caused by the lack of funding to address a problem that was identified by FEMA as a very, very important problem and it didn't get the funding. But secondly, also, that in the case of a natural disaster, the government will not help you within the 3-day timeline that most people expect and have come to expect from FEMA's activities in the past in other disasters. Now, if you go to the Red Cross website, you're thinking, I'm going to do a little bit of planning before a disaster hits Seattle. If you go to the Red Cross website and you go, or you look in other places for disaster planning, a lot of places they will tell you you need about a 3-day supply of food and water. Now, if people in New Orleans had prepared for that and set aside a 3-day supply of food and water and kept it safe from the floodwaters, they'd still be in trouble, because it's taken the government nearly a week. They would have gotten from Sunday when the storm hit through about Tuesday, and then they'd be in trouble, and they'd still be waiting, a lot of them, for some kind of help. So it's pretty clear that, you know, the government will not come in to help you. You have to do some of this planning on your own. And you better be generous in your estimates of how much food and water you're going to need.
How much of the delay in response and the delay in mobilization do you think was because the majority of the victims in this case were poor and black?
I have no idea. I mean, I can't get inside the heads of anybody in the federal government or any of the folks who are or trying to respond to this. But what I can tell you is on Monday night when the levees breached and the city started to flood, even before that time, on Monday, when it was clear that New Orleans was a disaster area, that there was flooding in at least one neighborhood, particularly a poor neighborhood in New Orleans.
Yeah, the lower Ninth Ward.
Yeah, and there were people who were stuck at the Superdome and the conditions there were getting worse. George Bush could have gotten on the phone and he could have called up the heads of major airlines and he could have said, look, the federal government will allocate the funds to pay for you to fly people out of there. I mean, he could have done that. He could have called up units that were readying to go over to the war in Iraq, and he could have said, you're being diverted. You know, he could have done any of those things. Instead, he waited until Tuesday, and I think it was late on Tuesday, to even start the process.
And if you want to talk about patronizing, the idea that he could review the damage of the hurricane by flying over it in Air Force One, I mean, just think, if anybody listening out there, how good a view you've gotten of a city by flying over it in an airplane.
We
don't even know if it was cloudy or not.
3,000 feet or, you know.
or 30,000 feet.
Or 30,000 feet.
I mean,
yeah.
It's just I mean, the gall of this administration at times is just overwhelming.
I know. So I think you're right. I think there is some component to that, whether it's because the victims were largely African American or because they were poor, I don't know. Probably because of a combination of those two. But also I think too, because the Bush administration doesn't operate in the real world. They operate in this idea of what they want the real world to be, this kind of neocon paradise of only the rich exist, and as long as we pursue the policies of the wealthy, then everybody else will be happy to follow along, and the poor can just take care of themselves, et cetera, et cetera. I think there's a large part of that.
I don't think the Bush administration and the officials who all make very good salaries and live in very comfortable worlds in Washington, D.C., understood that many people would not have the means to leave the city in a mandatory evacuation order.
Certainly the poor have been invisible to them, and they've made no effort to understand poverty or to see how many people in the United States are poor. In fact, I was telling Mike earlier that another million people fell below the poverty level in this country last year. It's now about 37 million people in the United States.
With that very, very low standard.
Live at that very, very low income level, below, you know, and above which people can still be extremely poor. So that gives you some idea of how widespread poverty is in the U.S. and how things like George Bush's tax cuts have exacerbated the problem.
Yeah, the poverty rates have been increasing steadily at the same time that the wealthy have been getting wealthier and wealthier in this country. I mean, mm-hmm. the gap between the two has been steadily increasing as well. This is something that the government has steadily pursued as a policy over the last 20 or 30 years.
Yeah. And so you know, getting back to Hurricane Katrina, we've talked about the political fallout from that, and I'll be surprised if George Bush lives this one down. But
I don't think he will. I think this is going to be extremely damaging to the administration. Mm-hmm. I think that there's been a very, very widespread perception that the response by this administration has been utterly incompetent. I mean, you've heard people on both sides of the aisle politically in Congress this week saying that this is absolutely unacceptable.
Mm-hmm.
And they should. I mean, it should prompt that kind of response.
Yeah.
I think this is going to be very damaging for the Bush administration.
Yeah.
And he won't lift it down.
Yeah. I think we need to also talk about some other causes of Hurricane Katrina, the environmental
like global warming.
Cause. Yeah. Uh-huh. You want to talk a little bit about that, John?
Well, we certainly can. I mean, we know that as a consequence of global warming, that storms are going to become more powerful and more frequent over the course of the next century, really. But even you know, we're in the upswing in terms of the natural cycle of 20 or 30 years whereby hurricanes become more frequent and more powerful. But beyond that natural cycle, we know that global warming causes the increases in ocean temperature, the increases in trade winds, all of the things that can contribute to a hurricane in Atlantic waters and cyclones in Pacific waters. This is something we're going to have to live with, and we have to prepare for these storms in the future.
Yeah, and as for this year, hurricane season's only half over. And
we're already at 13 hurricanes.
Yeah, meteorologists.
13 tropical storms, excuse me.
Yeah, meteorologists have predicted a 43% chance of another major hurricane hitting the U.S. Continent sometime between now and November when the hurricane season ends. Now, in addition, there are some other environmental aspects to this, too. The levees that have kept New Orleans low and dry for the last 300 years have been contributing to the problem, too, because silt from the Mississippi River that could have built up along the bank and kept the city from sinking has actually been pushed down and out into the Gulf. In addition, you had developers getting rid of a lot of the wetlands of southern Louisiana.
The wetlands and the barrier islands.
And the barrier islands that would have taken a lot of the force out of the storm and probably made it less likely that Hurricane Katrina could have hit land at such strength that as it did. So there are those things to consider as well, all things that, of course, you know, the locals as well as the state and federal government have done nothing to try and change. Now, so there's that environmental aspect to it. There's also, what is the economic fallout going to be from Hurricane Katrina? We've all seen that this week with higher gas prices, right?
Yeah, and the state of California has already launched an investigation into price gouging by the oil industry, something that Washington State could profitably do as well, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because something like that is going to have an eventual trickle-down effect, but isn't going to have that immediate effect that we see at the gas pump as soon as the hurricane hits. Oh, yeah, prices jump 30 to 50 cents a gallon. That's insane.
And more in other parts of the country. It's been approaching $4 a gallon in the southeast.
However, the future is going to look a lot like that, maybe with even higher gas prices because of what Hurricane Katrina did to the oil output in the Gulf. Something like 50% of U.S. refining capacity is on the Gulf Coast from Texas to Alabama in the refineries there. 9 of those refineries were shut down. 95% of the crude oil in the Gulf that's produced from the Gulf of Mexico was shut down. That's 25 to 30% of total U.S. production. In addition, the U.S. imports something like 10 million barrels a day of oil and 1 million of gasoline through Gulf Coast ports. And that's 10 million barrels a day and 1 million of gasoline total, about 60% of that through Gulf Coast ports. So not only have we seen a shutdown in U.S. crude oil production, in a large chunk of U.S. crude oil production, but a shutdown in refining capacity, which is even more important because no matter how many barrels of oil the Bush administration releases from the petroleum reserve, that's crude oil. It has to be refined. And when the refineries are shut down, you can't do jack with that oil. It's not going to be able to go from crude into your gas tank. It has to be refined into gasoline. And with the refineries shut down, that's going to be a huge bottleneck in the system. Now, foreign countries are helping us out by sending us shipments of oil and some shipments of gasoline, but it's gasoline that we're going to need, and that's going to be where we're going to feel the brunt of this whole.
And that's going to have huge
thing.
Implications for the national economy. Also, the port of New Orleans is a major port through which goods flow for much of the middle section of this country. You know, the whole Mississippi River system from the Rocky Mountains to the Appalachians depends on goods that flow through the port of New Orleans, and that port is shut down now.
Yeah, and much of the lower Mississippi is shut down because of the devastation from Hurricane Katrina. We saw that with the Red Cross and other organizations trying to get medical supplies and food and stuff in by boat. They haven't been able to navigate a lot of the waterways because of the damage. So that means a shutdown for shipping as well.
Well, we've gotten an email in from Linda who wanted to add that Ron Fournier of Associated Press had reported that the Army Corps of Engineers had asked for $105 million for hurricane and flood programs in New Orleans last year, and the White House had delivered all of $40 million for that.
So, yeah, that's correct.
Another indication of cutting things short there.
Yeah, and I think they had asked for something like $40 million to help finish shoring up some levees, particularly the 17th Street levee, that one that the section that failed in New Orleans, and the Bush administration gave them just a quarter of the money that they needed, not even really enough to start work on the project. So, yeah, I mean, this should be laid directly at George Bush's feet, saying, look here, you didn't provide the money for it, it's your problem.
And this is something, I mean, this is a basic function that we expect out of government. Government exists to handle those problems that are too big for individuals to handle on their own, for local governments and then state governments and then national governments. You progressively work your way toward bigger and bigger problems, and natural disasters are one of the biggest things that we rely on the federal government to deal with. And this is what you get when you have 30 years of ideology that says big government is bad, we need to have as little government as possible. Well, this is a basic function of government that we have shortchanged.
And again, reiterating what you guys had said earlier, I had seen in the papers covered several weeks back that the number of storms expected this year was like either doubling or tripling. They were expecting like 24 major storms to be hitting from the Atlantic coast into the southeast area there. So, again, you know, it was pretty predictable that something like this was coming.
They've already had more storms this year than a normal hurricane season and would have total, and the season's only half over.
Well, and something, of course, that is much needed now is supplies and support for everybody down there. And do you have particular, in addition to the KXP website, where we now have multiple links for people who want to make contributions, any particular organizations?
I contributed to America's Second Harvest to bring food to folks who were displaced by the storm. Certainly you can donate to the Red Cross and donate through your church. There are a lot of local churches, particularly here in Seattle, who are going to be drumming up donations from folks.
Yeah, and we'll be seeing a lot of fundraisers over the coming weeks and months for it. This is a problem that's not going to go away. You've literally got hundreds of thousands of people who are homeless, who have no jobs, who have no place to go, who have to be not just sheltered, not just put in some place like the Astrodome, but they have no money, they have no jobs, they have no lives, and communities across the country are going to have to absorb some of the burden of this.
Yeah, and there will be folks, I'm sure, who will step forward and open their houses and say, I can take a family. Mm. You know, your kids can go to school with my kids. Those kind of things that people will need, because, you know, the fixing of the city, it's going to take, they say now, something like 6 months to drain the city, potentially another year for it to dry out and another year to get it cleaned up. That's begging the question of whether or not anybody's going to want to move back to New Orleans, whether now it's a dead, it could now just be a dead city. So,
yeah, because there are no jobs waiting for them when they go back.
Yeah, so now, I mean, it still has value probably as a port for oil imports, et cetera. Although in the time it takes to clean it all up, those 2 years, we could see the oil moving to Texas ports or elsewhere, and that New Orleans could literally now be a dead city. That means all of those people, 500,000 people, are going to have to relocate somewhere.
Yeah, and that's just 500,000 in the city limits. There's over 1 million in the metropolitan area.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, I just think people will move back there. I just know if it was
yeah,
myself.
I think they will.
I don't think there'd be a problem.
Yeah, I think they will, too. I think New Orleans will rebound to some extent, but it'll never be the city that it was.
Mm-hmm. Also, I would suspect that people should be emphasizing with their own local representatives the importance of planning for disasters now. I mean, if the tsunami and this doesn't make it evident that we need to reprioritize things, you know? I don't know what those people need.
Yeah, we need to
get out of Iraq. We need to stop spending the money on tax cuts for the rich and the estate tax that's coming up when Congress gets back from its break.
We need to take personal responsibility you know, for you and your family, looking for what kind of disaster planning you can do. But at the same time, you need to turn around and demand that local officials, state officials, federal officials start putting an emphasis on real security things like planning for a disaster. And what are you going to do to get people out of their homes when something like this hits? How are you going to take care of them?
Yeah, and when there are people who don't have resources, don't have cars, don't have mobility, don't just throw up your arms and say, well, those people don't count, mm-hmm. which I think is a lot of what happened with Hurricane Katrina.
Yeah.
All right. Well, moving along, we're going to jump over then to This Week in Iraq.
This Week in Iraq.
Yeah, after Hurricane Katrina, it seems kind of trivial to talk about Iraq, but Iraq is very important for reasons that we mentioned earlier. And so I'm going to tell you that the Iraq war is now costing more per month than the Vietnam War did in inflation-adjusted dollars. Right now, we're paying $5.6 billion per month to fund the war in Iraq. That's about $186 million per day. The average cost of the Vietnam War, this is over 8 years of the most fighting in Vietnam, was $5.1 billion per month. That's about $500 million less than the war in Iraq is costing us now. The total cost of the Vietnam War over those 8 years was $600 billion. The total cost of the Iraq War so far in a little over 2 years is $200 billion and rising. Congress is probably going to set aside another $45 to $50 billion.
Why is the war in Iraq so expensive?
Can you guess? Donald Rumsfeld said, well, we don't need as many troops as we used in earlier wars, like, for example, Vietnam. We need more toys, in essence, more kill toys, so let's spend the money for them. Also, you have these huge corporations like Halliburton and Bechtel and others who are charging, and in many cases, I'm sure, overcharging in order to bring supplies to troops in Iraq and to bring gasoline.
That's all been privatized since Vietnam.
And it's all been made much more expensive as a result. And in addition, we're losing the war in Iraq, and that's showing in the amount of money we're spending. Certainly, we weren't winning the war in Vietnam either, but I think in Iraq, we're probably taking a worse beating. Now, if you break that amount of money that we're spending per month that we've spent so far on the Iraq war, that's something like $727 per person in the United States, and it's not expected to end anytime soon. Now, also another way that you can measure the cost of the war in Iraq is the number of journalists who have died in Iraq as opposed to the number of journalists who died in Vietnam. So far, 67 journalists have been killed in Iraq versus 63 who died in Vietnam. But if you look at those numbers a little more closely, you'll see that 63 journalists who were killed in Vietnam, that was over a 20-year period from 1955 to 1975, and that includes the French occupation period of Vietnam. So that's telling you a little bit about exactly how bad things are in Iraq, in spite of the fact that the U.S. press is not reporting on it. So I think that will just wrap up This Week in Iraq.
All right. And then briefly, we only got about a minute left to cover this. The locally here in Seattle, the Boeing machinists have gone on strike.
Yeah, and the newspapers and TV stations here have done a really bad job of explaining why exactly the strike is happening. It's happening basically over pension and medical benefits. Boeing company has gotten an increase in orders in its commercial jet division in the last year. They're doing relatively well, and so workers are trying to make up for cutbacks that have been implemented in past contracts. The idea being that you accept cutbacks from the company in bad times, and then you get rewarded in good times. Well, the company's offer instead was for more cutbacks, basically in medical and in pension benefits as well. And the strike vote was overwhelming. It was 86% voted not just to reject the contract offer, but to go on strike. And this is going to be a long one.
All right. talking once again with Jav Parrish and Maria Tomchik, co-editors at Eat the State. And tell people where they can find Eat the State.
Eat the State, I should mention, because I said this erroneously last time, we changed our minds in terms of the endorsements. They're not in the current issue. They will be in the next issue. But you can still find the current issue of Eat the State. It's at places where you get free publications, newspapers, periodicals, bookstores and cafes, places like that. You can also find us on the web, www.eatthestate.org, and we will have those endorsements for you in the next issue. And we'll start doing them on the air here in a couple weeks, too.
Very good.